Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is March 16, 2024, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. This is an SGEM Extra episode. Yes, that is two back-to-back SGEM Extra episodes. The critical appraisal that I had planned for this week got delayed due to some scheduling problems with clinical responsibilities. So for this episode, it is a talk I gave a few years ago on social media for knowledge translation and how it can make the world a better place. I've come to recognize that many SGEMers are not very familiar with the best movie decade of all time, the 1980s. Therefore, I have created this talk using The Matrix as a more contemporary theme from the late 1990s and early 2000s. To remind people, The Matrix was a groundbreaking movie created by Lana and Lily Wachowski and released in 1999. It started a movie franchise blending science fiction and action together in this visual masterpiece. The first movie introduces us to a dystopian future in which humanity is unknowingly trapped inside The Matrix, a simulated reality created by intelligent machines to distract humans while using their bodies as an energy source or batteries. Thomas Anderson, or Mr. Anderson, a computer program by day and hacker named Neo by night, discovers the truth about the Matrix. He's drawn into a rebellion against the machines led by Morpheus and Trinity. Neo is believed to be the One, the prophesied hero destined to end the war between humans and machines. The film explores themes of reality, freedom, and control. And like Morpheus in The Matrix, all I'm offering is the truth, nothing more. What if I told you? Morpheus never said that in The Matrix, yet "What if I told you" is one of the most famous known memes. And there are many quotes from movies that get misquoted all the time. I'll just give you three examples to make the point. The first one is, "Play it again, Sam." That was from Casablanca in 1942. And that quote, "Play it again, Sam," is never said in the movie Casablanca. Humphrey Bogart, the actor, actually says, "You played it for her, you can play it for me. If she can stand it, I can. Play it." Or how about, "Luke, I am your father." That's from Star Wars, episode number 5, The Empire Strikes Back, in 1980. But the actual line by Darth Vader is, "No, I am your father." And I'm sure Seth Kruger knew the correct line. And the third and final example I'll use is, "If you build it, they will come," from Field of Dreams in 1989. And that was actually never said. The actual line is, "People will come, Ray. People will come." I'll put a list in the show notes of the top 10 movie misquotes. But back to the lecture. Morpheus, sitting in his chair wearing super cool sunglasses, was offering Neo a red pill or a blue pill, but he never said, quote, "What if I told you?" The actual dialogue in the scene, Morpheus says, quote, "Do you want to know what it is?" So what it is for today's lecture is the problem with knowledge translation and how it can be addressed by social media. In the movie The Matrix, Trinity tells Neo that, quote, "It's the question that drives us, Neo. It's the question that brought you here. You know the question, just as I did." And from the movie, the question is, what is the Matrix? And for this lecture, the question is, how long does it take for high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach the patient's bedside? So there are a few answers to that question on how long it takes for knowledge translation. One answer is from Dr. John Jackson, a British neurologist. He said, it takes 50 years to get a wrong idea out of medicine and 100 years a right one into medicine. Now, in my opinion, that is way too long in the age of social media. Now, in the movie The Matrix, Cypher played the role of an older guy who knew the answer, what is the Matrix? That he was just a copper top human battery giving energy to support the machines. It was all an elaborate simulation, and he was content with being in the Matrix and did not care that he was living an illusion. Another answer to the question about how long knowledge translation can take comes from a famous physicist, Max Planck. He said, quote, "New scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die and a new generation grows up that is familiar with it." In other words, it was not facts, evidence, or logical arguments that convinced people to change their position on a subject, but rather the old guys, and it usually was guys, had to die out first for the new information to take hold and become accepted. This takes a generation. Now, the character Tank in the movie The Matrix was a new guy filled with hope that Neo, the chosen one, would change the world for the better, breaking everyone free from the Matrix. So Morris et al. Published a paper in 2011 trying to put an exact number on how long does it take for high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach patients. They came up with 17 years as the answer. Now, this is not for 100% of that clinical information to reach the patient, but only 14%. So this was published back in 2011 in the Journal of the Royal Society of Medicine. And while I think that the specific number of 17 years and 14%, I don't think the specific numbers is as important as the concept that it can take a long time, more than a decade sometimes, for a minority of clinically relevant evidence to be widely adopted by clinicians. So why does it take so long in medicine? A model has been put together that identifies seven major issues that prevent patients from getting the best care based on the best evidence. The first five are at the level of the clinician, and the last two are patient-level problems. So those seven problems or leaks in the leaky pipe model of knowledge translation are awareness, acceptance, applicable, able, act on, agree, and adhere. And we'll go through and describe each of those seven A's shortly. Now, it's not hard to find many examples of this knowledge translation gap or leaky pipe in medicine, showing how long it can take for high-quality, clinically relevant information to reach patients. One example of this knowledge translation gap would be the number of antibiotics written by clinicians for things like the common cold, acute otitis media, bronchitis, and sinusitis. We have known for years, if not decades, that many of these things are caused by viruses. And even though some of them can be caused by bacteria, there is little evidence that antibiotics have a significant impact on the disease course. Yet when you look at it, the number one reason clinicians have written antibiotics for adults is bronchitis. And it's about 90% of those are viral. And the number one reasons clinicians write antibiotics for children is acute otitis media. And again, we know that in certain children, I think it's over the age of two, about 85% will resolve spontaneously on their own without antibiotics. So let's go through those seven leaks of knowledge translation. Remember, that was awareness, acceptance, applicable, able, act on, agree, and adhere, with the first five being on the clinicians and the last two being on the patients. So that first leak or that first problem is awareness. Accessibility to information has never been easier in this modern era of the internet, yet accessibility to high quality information can sometimes be difficult. Now, typically, translation of medical research is done at the local level where the research is done. Then sometimes that research will be presented at a meeting as an oral poster or as a oral presentation. Now, not all research eventually gets published, at least in part due to publication bias, where studies that report positive findings, and I'm using air quotes for positive, in other words, a statistically significant value, and we're not going to go down the whole p-value rabbit hole right now, but they're more likely to be published than those studies that didn't demonstrate a clinically significant, a statistically significant difference based on p-value, so considered a, quote, negative study. But I don't like to dichotomize positive and negative that way. But there is something called publication bias. And then if something does get published, there are journals that have paywalls to access that information. On top of all of that, there can be information overload, inadequate time, inefficient search strategies. It is hard to act upon something as a clinician if you do not know that the research even exists. So that's awareness. A second problem is acceptance of the data. You may not accept the evidence for a variety of reasons. Perhaps it's because the evidence is a statement by an eminent physician, and they said so. And you want more than just an argument from an authority. Now, just because they're authority doesn't make them right and it doesn't make them wrong. It's just a low level of evidence. And everyone will have a different level of evidence that they consider sufficient to accept a claim. And of course, it'll all be dependent on the claim that's being made. There needs to be some proportionality to it. Your personal experience as well may be contradictory to the evidence that is being suggested, so there could be a problem with external validity. You might also be concerned about some conflicts of interest, which again, don't necessarily invalidate the evidence, but it should make us more skeptical of the evidence. We do need to be careful to exercise healthy skepticism when we're looking at accepting a claim and not drift into denialism, like denying it, or nihilism where you say nothing works. The third problem of knowledge translation is applicable. Uncertainty about the interpretation of the evidence to apply the data clinically. Now that uncertainty could be around the demographics of the study population, and does that match closely enough to the demographics of the population you're treating or the individual that you're treating? You may be concerned that while the study shows statistical significant difference, is it clinically significant and therefore applicable? The fourth problem is able. Resource constraints and skill competence that would make it able to apply the evidence in your local population. An example would be the difference between practicing in a rural versus an urban environment. Many of the rural sites I work at don't have a lumbar puncture kit to do a spinal tap. The rural hospital labs also do not have a microbiology ability to do Gram stains for something like meningitis. So while the evidence may say an LP should be performed, but we're not able to do that necessarily in a rural setting. Therefore, when we see a patient with suspected meningitis, we just might load them up with appropriate antibiotics and then also load them up into the back of an ambulance to transport them to a higher level of care that is able to perform the lumbar puncture. And then problem number five, and this is the fifth problem on the physician or clinician side of things, and that is act on. The emergency department is a chaotic environment, and there are frequent distractions, squirrel, with many competing mandates. Everyone, so patients and every specialist, cardiology, neurology, critical care, etc., they all think their patient is the most important person to be seen first. And we have things like code stroke, code myocardial infarction, code sepsis. And when everyone is a priority, it ends up nobody being a priority. And in fact, all patients are important. All patients deserve appropriate and timely access to emergency care. But patients come to the emergency department undifferentiated. They don't have a diagnosis written on their forehead. A weak, older patient can present similarly, both having an MI or a stroke. Or it could be sepsis. They come in with a constellation of signs and symptoms, not a diagnosis written on their forehead. They will also likely not be the only person in the emergency department at that time. There may be somebody there with a mental health crisis, abdominal pain, and oh, is it an appendicitis? Is it diverticulitis? Is it a AAA, an aortic aneurysm? There can be a child with a broken arm, a worker with a dominant hand laceration, etc., etc. We do not have unlimited resources like staff, room, equipment, and people are often waiting hours to be seen by emergency department clinicians and days to be admitted to an inpatient ward. So while there may be these metrics saying an ECG needs to be done, antibiotics need to be given, CT head needs to be obtained, etc., all within a certain time frame, we may not be able to act on this information. We are aware of the objective. We accept the objective. We agree with the objective. Can apply the objective at our site, but we're just not able to act on the information due to the various constraints. And then when you look at patient level issues, there's two. So the first one is agree. It can be information overload for them. They may have competing interests and they need to agree with the clinician on what is the best way forward. They are the experts at their own personal experience and journey, while the clinicians are experts at the medical literature or their clinical skills, those types of things. And so you need to put those two expertise together, the clinician's expertise and the patient's expertise. And then at the end, the patient needs to agree with the plan. And remember that evidence-based medicine is more than just the relevant medical literature and the clinician's judgment. The patient will have their own values and preferences that must be considered. Shared decision-making should be practiced respecting patients' agency and autonomy. They can make choices about their health we do not necessarily agree with or would make for ourselves. And then the seventh and final leak or a problem with knowledge translation is adhere. And that's again on the patient side of things. I don't like the term maybe adhere. I prefer concordance maybe, but they had seven A's, so adhere. So if we prescribe an antibiotic for 10 days, let's say, and the patient feels better in five and they stop taking their antibiotic and then they put it aside and then when they start feeling sick the next time, they start taking it. This would be an example of not adhering to the clinical recommendations. But lack of adherence doesn't necessarily need to be overt. It could also just be forgetfulness. Taking multiple pills a day can be complicated, especially if something is prescribed to be taken four times a day. I personally take two prescription pills once a day in the morning. Do I forget sometimes to adhere as a patient to that regimen? Yes, I do. So, there is this knowledge translation problem in clinical medicine. It can take more than a decade, often, for even a minority of high-quality, clinically relevant evidence to reach the patient. This is in part due to those seven leaks in knowledge translation pipeline. The five, due to clinician issues, awareness, acceptance, applicable, able, and act on, and two, due to patient issues, agree and adhere. I would suggest that social media, yes, that's right, social media could be a solution to the knowledge translation problem. Things like YouTube, podcasts, blogs, X, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, and other platforms. When it comes to social media and medical education, it's called FOMED, Free Open Access to Medical Education. The story of FOMED goes back over 10 years to a group of Australians having a pint of beer in Ireland in a pub in 2012. Now, FOMED is not supposed to be a teaching philosophy or strategy, but rather a globally accessible, crowdsourced educational adjunct providing inline or contextual and offline asynchronous content to augment traditional education principles. Steve Jobs is famous for being an innovator and a disruptor and encouraged us to think different. FOMED is challenging us in this space of medical education to think different. And FOMED has one objective: to make the world a better place. So why use FOMED? Well, to find all the signal in the noise. Remember, I told you that there's just so much information. It is hard for anyone to stay up on the medical literature. It can seem like you're trying to drink water from a fire hose at times. It's very hard for clinicians who are very busy to be able to read all the new relevant medical literature while still providing care to patients. There are roughly 4,000 biomedical publications in PubMed every day, almost 100 randomized control trials, and a dozen systematic reviews published every day. And then when COVID hit, things got even harder because there were about 200 publications or pre-pubs every day just on COVID alone. However, FOMED can jack you into the knowledge. It can filter the signal from all that noise, delivering you the information on multiple platforms like blogs, podcasts, Instagram, X. You can follow people that have credibility, that have demonstrated to be reliable on social media to get the latest news, information, and critical appraisals. Blogs often have post-publication peer review done long before the letters to the editor or opinion articles get written or published. You can also use social media in the form of FOMED to time leverage by listening to podcasts while you're commuting to work. I call this turning your car into a classroom. Or you can listen to the podcast while you're working out so you can exercise your mind and your body. Now, it's not as easy as it was in the Matrix to download programs directly into your brain saying, "I know Kung Fu," but it can certainly help. The Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine, or the SGEM, is the knowledge translation project I started back in 2012 after attending the Center for Evidence-Based Medicine at Oxford University. The SGEM consists of a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication delivered as a podcast and a blog. It's also tied to a Facebook page, ActiveX feed, YouTube channel, and Instagram. I even started doing some TikToks for a paper in a minute. Each season of the SGEM is also published as a PDF book. The SGEM has grown over the 12 years to have greater than 80,000 subscribers and gets between 2 to 3 million Twitter impressions per episode. Now, the goal is to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media. Ultimately, we at the SGEM want patients to get the best care based on the best evidence. Speaking of evidence, does this social media FOMED stuff really work? Well, the first leak in the leaky pipe model of knowledge translation, if you remember, is awareness. And we do have evidence that social media can impact this knowledge translation problem. Brent Toma and colleagues published in the Canadian Journal of Emergency Medicine demonstrating that infographics and podcasts can increase dissemination and awareness. Infographics had an altmetric score almost three times, so 300% more than that of control, where podcasts, that's mainly MySpace, had an altmetric score of more than five times or 500% greater than control. Those of you who are not familiar with altmetrics, this is a service that tracks and analyzes the online activity surrounding publications of academic literature. It measures the attention that research receives beyond the traditional citations and the mentions that you get in social media. So altmetrics provides an altmetric attention score, which is a quantifiable measure of the impact and influence of research papers or outputs in the digital environment. So to answer the question about does social media stuff really work, the answer is yes. Social media can plug the awareness leak in the leaky pipe model of knowledge translation. That does not mean there have not been many criticisms of social media. People have spoken up and out about their concerns about using social media for knowledge translation. However, these are generally not new arguments. This criticism about social media goes back at least 2,500 years. An excellent book on this is by Tom Standridge called Writing on the Wall, Social Media the First 2,000 Years. And I'm going to go through just three examples that are from this excellent book. We can start with the 4th century BC when Socrates was complaining about his students and their use of social media. He's reported to have said it can weaken the mind. Forgetful learners. They will trust external written sources. That the students will appear omniscient, but generally know nothing. They will be hearers of many things and will have learned nothing. And what Socrates was referring to was his students writing down his teaching on papyrus. Yes, paper was the social media of the 4th century BC. And the great irony of this whole story is that if this had not been written down, we would not know about his criticisms of the social media. And how is this different than complaining about today's medical students or residents who don't know anything and need access to a second brain in the form of a smartphone? And if it was worth knowing, students would not need to look it up by reaching into their pocket, pulling out their smartphone, and finding the answer. They would just know the answer because that knowledge was worth knowing and they should be able to remember it. Now let's jump forward to the 14th and 15th century. Gutenberg was credited with creating a printing press in 1439. However, the Chinese were doing this hundreds of years earlier. The movable printing type was a device that changed the world. This printing press started a revolution, and the revolution it started was in 1517 by a priest named Martin Luther. And he was upset with the church for a variety of reasons, and he wrote down his reasons on a list and then nailed his letter to the wall of the church. But really, people didn't know about that. But then, got a hold of a printing press and printed out his criticisms or concerns about the Catholic Church. Now, I'm not saying it went viral, but he did print out this pamphlet and it went fungal. It crept across Europe and it caused a reformation. So the criticism of social media at that time was that anyone could print out anything if they had a printing press and distribute these pamphlets. And this is a similar argument about bloggers. Anyone can sit there in their basement and start a blog and start ranting about anything, even the medical literature. But that doesn't make it right or wrong. It's the content that's important, not the tool, or in this case, the printing press originally, and now blogs, that's important. It's the content that's important. And a final stop, a final example, would be the middle of the 17th century. And this is when coffee houses came to Europe. And there were more coffee houses than pubs at one time. These coffee houses were referred to as penny universities. Patrons could pay a penny, sit down, drink their coffee, and debate the latest pamphlets that were coming off the printing presses. And it didn't matter whether they were a prince or a pauper, so it leveled sort of the social status. It was a bit sexist, though, because it said, no man of any station need give his place to a finer man. Gentry, tradesmen are all welcome hither, and may without affront sit down together. So in other words, you could come together, pay your penny at this penny university, read the latest pamphlets, and have a debate in these coffee houses about the literature and the world. But the criticism was, it was a waste of time, and it was distracting people chatting about trivial things when they should be doing something useful. In fact, the Oxford University authorities objected to these coffee houses because they feared it would promote laziness in students and that students would sit around in these coffee houses rather than going to the library. And so what does this have to do with social media? Well, members of the Royal Society, where Hooke, Wren, and Halley, of Halley's Comet fame, were discussing the theory of gravity. And this led Halley to, when they're having this conversation in a coffee house at Penny University, Halley went to visit Newton in Cambridge and had a follow-up discussion about this coffee house discussion where apparently people were wasting time. And what happened as a result of that coffee house discussion? Newtonian physics. Sir Isaac Newton published his Principia Mathematica. And so there might be a number of students, quote, wasting their time sitting around in a coffee shop, I won't use a name of a coffee shop, but one of the popular brands, and connecting to the internet and talking to other people around the world, and they may solve problems. They may come up with amazing discoveries because they're having these conversations electronically using social media, sitting in a coffee shop, and going online. I guess the bottom line is social media is a tool. And it's how you use the tool that is more important than the tool itself. And that tool can be used for great good, like Neo, the chosen one in The Matrix, or great evil, like Agent Smith, who's trying to destroy Neo in The Matrix. So when it comes to social media, I would suggest, you know, just start. Get on some social media platforms. Be a bit of a lurker for a while. Watch and see the interactions. And then once you become comfortable, you can interact, you can create content, you can respond. I would just encourage you to be kind. Don't be a jerk. Make your interactions honorable. And of course, enjoy. I mean, it's social media, so it's supposed to be social. Have a good time. Show your personality. Be true to yourself. So social media has shrunk the world, and it can be used to address the knowledge translation gap. It has the potential to make the world a better place. It just all depends on how we choose to use this technology. All right, that's it for this SGEM Extra episode. The SGEM will be back next time, I promise, doing a structured critical appraisal of a recent publication, trying to cut that knowledge translation window down from over 10 years to less than 1 year using the power of social media. So patients get the best care based on the best evidence. And if you would like a copy of the slides that I used in this presentation, I'll put a link in the show notes, and you can also go over to YouTube and actually see all the slides and listen to the talk. And finally, remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you heard it on the Skeptic's Guide to emergency medicine.